Hamas will be disarmed and Gaza Strip should be demilitarized. If it could be done by others, great. If it cannot be done by others, we will have to do it.
Welcome to the Miskab Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons podcast, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in Israel and the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. The Miskab Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances. I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Miskab Institute. My co-host, Lav Harkov, is currently in the United States for the JFNA General Assembly, and she will hopefully be back next week. Please subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts in order to stay up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to Israel and the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments, questions, suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com, and we read and respond to all your comments, so please keep them coming. This week on Mideast Horizons, we interview member of Knesset Benny Gantz, head of the Blue and White National Unity Party, and former Israeli Defense Forces Chief of Staff, Israeli Defense Minister, Deputy, and Alternate Prime Minister. We go in depth into the urgent security challenges facing the state of Israel in Gaza, in the north along the Lebanese and Syrian border, in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, as well as his proposal for a new security doctrine or paradigm for the state of Israel, entitled Israel Security Vision 2040. Of course, we also touch on Israeli politics and the debate over the establishment of a state commission of inquiry into the October 7th events and the lead up to those events. Member of Knesset Gantz had a long and decorated military career, serving among other roles as commander of the IDF's Judea and Samaria Division, commander of the IDF Northern Command, as Israel's military attaché in the United States, before becoming IDF Chief of Staff, a role in which he served from 2011 to 2015. He entered politics in 2018, serving as Speaker of the Knesset. In 2020, during the COVID-19 pandemic, he entered the government-led or rotation government led by Prime Minister Netanyahu, serving as Minister of Defense. He also served as Minister of Defense under the government led by Prime Minister Bennett. Of course, there was a lot of politics in between those various stages, but I won't get into that right now. Following Hamas's October 7th, 2023 massacre, he joined the government as a member of the war cabinet and played a key role in Israel's decision-making in the Seven Front War in which it was engaged until he left the war cabinet in June 2024. One other detail that I'd like to mention, both Benny Gantz's mother and father were Holocaust survivors, and I'm sure that when Benny Gantz's mother was in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, she could not have imagined that her son would grow up to be the Israeli Defense Forces Chief of Staff or the Israeli Defense Minister. So in that sense, Benny Gantz's story really represents the story of Israel's rebirth and restoration. So without further ado, please stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Benny Gantz. Member of Knesset Gantz, it's a great pleasure to have you on the Miskav Mideast Horizons podcast, and especially today when Israel is at a critical turning point. The UN Security Council has just passed a resolution endorsing President Trump's 20-point plan. There's presumably a ceasefire in Gaza, but Hamas has declared that it does not intend to disarm and demilitarize the Gaza Strip. The northern border may be heating up. Iran certainly hasn't said the last word in its desire to take revenge on Israel. And I've long been concerned that Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, may be the next arena. And we saw today on the Tuesday, the 18th, the murderous terror attack that took place in the Gush Etzion Junction. Now, member of Knesset Gantz, in light of October 7th and the multi-front war that Israel has faced since that day, you published a new security vision for the state of Israel, Israel Security Vision 2040. Can you tell us a little bit about what are the core pillars of that vision and how you think Israel's security doctrine or security paradigm needs to change following October 7th and following the multi-front war that we faced since then?
Yes, thank you. First of all, it's a pleasure to be with you. And I think that any opportunity to have a deep discussion over the situation around us is a very important opportunity, and I'm very happy to take advantage of that. And as you rightly said, we are in a very complicated situation. Now, we must understand that since October 7th, we are creating a massive and strategic shift within the area in so many different elements. So I would like to separate, if you wish, between what is it that we have to do now and how is it that we have to think strategically towards the future in terms of force buildup, etc., etc. So definitely we must make sure that Hamas does not get to govern Gaza, definitely not what he had before, but even not what he had right now, which is kind of west from the yellow line, whatever it is, portrayed on the agreement and maps. Now, this international decision led by the United States of disarming Hamas and dismantling Hamas and rebuilding Gaza in a way that the Gazans people can live with and we can live beside, I think it's the right decision. I think it will take many, many years to get there. But I think we are on the right track. From day one, I thought we have to think on the day after. Not that I had a solution, but I knew that we would have to try out and things will fail and we'll have to try again, different deeds, I would say. But eventually, you know, I hugged Yossi Bachar. Yossi Bachar is a major general from Southern Command, from Kibbutz Be'eri. He fought on October 7 in his kibbutz, killed several, almost 15 or 16 terrorists within the kibbutz itself.
His mother was murdered that day in Beirut, right?
Yeah. Right. And when I first met him, like a day or two later, I hugged him and I told him, Yossi, you know, I'm very sorry, etc. But Hamas controlled Gaza from 2007. It's over. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I definitely understand that's what's going to happen. So looking at that area or this local issue, we must make sure Hamas doesn't get to govern Gaza. It has to be military dismantled, and Gaza Strip should be a demilitarized area where people can live within and we can live with or beside it over there. Now, that's a local issue. Tied to it, it's the Palestinians. They need to reform themselves. And if before I thought of two-state solution as a two-state illusion, I'm quite positive that this is not an issue we can move forward with right now. It's a future conditional performance-based situation that we will have to reach in order to move forward with the Palestinians. You know, I met with Abu Mazen. I think I'm the only senior politician who met with him. By the way, he was 90 last week, I think.
He's in the 21st year of his four-year term.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is a day after within the Palestinian Authority, and they have to reform themselves. They have to be able to control themselves, and not before they will be willing to kill and being willing to get killed in order to make sure security and order is in place. There's not much we can do with them. They have to fix themselves in terms of security. They have to fix themselves in terms of governance. They have to fix themselves in terms of education system and incitement that we see in all those places. And I suggest that we will support them on that track. But in both areas, whether it's in Judea and Samaria or whether it's in Gaza, I suggest for us to look at reality as it is and not as we hope it to be. And once we're on that, I think that down the road we'll figure out what to do locally. Now, regionally speaking, it is most important to tie in the Saudis and other countries into the Abraham Accords. I think there is a good chance of doing it. Once again, you know, I'm looking for peace resolution with everyone, so I can credibly say that I'm willing to speak with whoever I can, but I'm willing to fight whoever I need. So I can combine those two things pretty easy, I would say. So regionally, I think we have to increase Abraham Accords with the Saudis and others to strengthen the peace accord we have with Egypt and Jordan. I think it's possible. I think it's doable. Hopefully to come to some kind of security arrangements with the Syrians and the Lebanese, once again backed by the West, so we can secure ourselves regionally and create a better, more, I would say, stabilized area. Now we are left with the strategic issue of Iran, obviously. And we saw what happened on April and October of April 24 and October, I think, of 24. What is regional agreement can benefit? How can we all benefit from them? Because if you remember, before October 7 war, the biggest attack on in the region by the Iranians was against the Saudis, Aramco sites. Now, we have this Middle East aerial defense, and we can actually expand it to Middle East regional defense, or whatever the acronyms would stand.
What does it actually look like? Do you envision Israeli and Saudi and Jordanian officers sitting in a CENTCOM base somewhere in Doha or in Amman and, you know, sharing information from radars?
Yeah. You know, with information capacity today, we can do it, not necessarily sitting together, but yeah, basically coordinating and sharing through the right channels and through the right ways. Intelligence, if needed, of course, everybody will keep his own intelligence for himself, but we can figure out what we can share and how we can benefit each other. So by doing so, we are creating, if you wish, a moderate camp, Abrahamic camp, facing radical Iran with very dangerous aspirations of nuclear capacity and different trajectories of different distances that we must remember that they are developing. And we see it here in Israel, we saw it in Saudi, we see it on a daily basis in Ukraine through the Russian hands, but it's basically Iranian. So I think it is very important. Now, I believe that United States, the Western countries, the democratic world, the region of the Abrahamic region, all share the same interest of facing Iran. It's just how we do it. So going back to the question you actually asked me, so what have changed, right? What have changed is that if we had four pillars in our defense capacity, you know, we started with three of deterrence and then alert and then strategic alert and then decisive operations. And then we added the trajectory era, we added the defense and shields system. I now suggest to add a strategic initiative pillar to this concept. And when we see something which is strategically threatening us or anyone else, and it is something meaningful that you cannot live beside it. Like, think of it. How could we live besides Gaza? I mean, look at it. We had an Iranian division sitting on our borders, and we just waited for something to happen. I'm taking it to the extreme because, you know, seriously speaking, I bow my head with professional shame for what happened on October 7. I think it could be prevented, but it is what it is, you know. Just like it was prevented up north with Hezbollah, you know, 16 Fajr that could do nothing when actually the day came, because we were prepared for them. But I suggest that if it's a strategic risk to take in a strategic initiative, now it can be a political one, maybe you can solve it politically. I'm not saying that shooting someone is the first option, but it is an option. It is an option. We conducted several times, and actually I was the first one to do so, a preemptive strike against terrorists that were about to operate against us.
Mm-hmm.
So just multiply it by thousands and figure out.
When was the first time?
Well, at the Second Intifada, when Second Intifada started, like the year of 2001, at the beginning of it, the area of Bethlehem. I think this is something we have to take in consideration once again. This is not your first option, but it is an option. Now, in order for it to be an option, you have to set up the strategic environment, politically, media, social, intelligence sharing, You prepare your own society for that. Make sure you have the right stockpiles for everything. This is not something that comes out of your, you know, just an afternoon decision. This is something very serious that have to be prepared legally and everything that you can think of. So this is something I think we should work on. You can add to it the logistic aspect of increasing industrial base, whether it's in Israel or whether it's through cooperation with other countries like the East Med or other countries that you can think of critical elements that we need them in real time. If you try to stockpile, if everybody will try to stockpile for himself, no one could do it. It would be too expensive to everybody. But if we can create some kind of international partnership between countries that share the same values and share the same interest, then if we can stockpile strategic elements that then need it into the defense industry in real time, so you have whatever you have to start your fight with, whatever you have to pack yourself up, but whatever you can produce in real time, but you have the critical elements for that. Otherwise, you'll get stuck in no time. So I think those are the directions that we need to add. And I'm sure that we have to do it because one of the main lessons learned within this event that we are going through is that one cannot afford the existence of strategic capacity in the hands of radicals. Because there's what I call jihadic multiplier. I mean, think of it. Sinwar was not a stupid guy. I think if he would ask himself and the leadership of Hamas, if they would ask themselves, what might be the reaction of Israel or other any other one for what they did, I mean, logically speaking, they wouldn't do it. Nevertheless, they did. If you go back to Nasrallah himself said on the Second Lebanon War, he said, if I would think for 1% that that's what Israel is going to do, I would never do it, right? But nevertheless, he did what he did in 2006, and he did join Hamas this time, truly speaking, just as a operational solidarity. Or the Houthis that know what's happening in Yemen for what they are doing. But nevertheless, they are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a segment of religious belief that one cannot anticipate what would be the act of the people themselves. You may not chase every AK-47, but yeah, missiles, the visions of invasion, nuclear capabilities, this is something that the world cannot live with.
So let's break that down. You were chief of staff during two major operations in Gaza, the 2012 Operation Pillar of Defense and 2014 Operation Protective Edge. You were defense minister during another major operation in Gaza, 2021, Guardian of the Walls. And in each of those operations, Israel acted intensively, but it didn't go, it's called all out, in terms of trying to defeat Hamas, in terms of trying to capture large areas of the Gaza Strip or hold them for extended periods of time, presumably because Israel had the sense that it didn't want to get bogged down in Gaza while it was facing, perhaps in its view, more severe threats, whether from Hezbollah in the north or from Iran. It wanted to, you know, deal a severe blow to Hamas and then refocus on other threats that it considered more existential. If Israel had adopted the pillar that you're suggesting now, back then, a decade ago or a decade and a half ago, would it have been the right thing to do to launch a all-out extended campaign in Gaza?
If you look at it in a retrospect, you may think that's the right direction. But you need to look at the decisions when they were made and what was the situation when they were made, right? I don't think we had the strategic environment that enabled us to do what we did now then. I don't think that the times of President Obama, we could do a 2 years war in Gaza. I don't think in times of different situation, we could have done what we did in Iran or elsewhere. So it's all question of strategic environment. Now, even if we would have the strategic environment, we still had to stockpile everything and to prepare everything. And don't forget that all those operations that you are talking were not initiatives. They were a reaction to what Hamas did. And when you try to eliminate strategic element, it has to be initiated. You may take an advantage that someone gave you an opportunity, and then you go out with something that you have prepared, but that was not the case. Now, on October 7, I don't know, 3,000 terrorists and looters and invaded Israel. How many did so in Pillar of Defense? Zero. How many did so in Protective Edge? Zero. Those that pop out from the first tunnel were killed there, right on the spot. And there was another squad that succeeded to enter in, two squads that succeeded to get out of the tunnels, but they were killed immediately. No civilians actually were hit. So even if you look at the legitimacy of your internal legitimacy to do whatever you would like to do, you need to have some kind of reasonable reference. And I don't think that was the situation then. Therefore, rightly so, I believe that the government have decided on limited goal for the campaign themselves in both or third, all those three cases. And I think it was reasonable one at the time. However, I am urging to assemble judicial inquiry of the situation right now. And I suggest for it to start at 2007 when Hamas took over Gaza. And look at everything that happened since then. If you wish, even I would say 2006, the end of Lebanon War, the rebuilt force of Hezbollah, I would go for that. You want to go for 2005, 2005, whatever. I need to give explanation on 7 years of that. I'm not running away from being asked hard questions and figure out my strategic lessons and maybe even take some personal responsibilities. Not that I think of any misconduct that I've done in my life, but let's say, let those who do the inquiry decide for that. And I think, by the way, that this inquiry, with your permission, one more sentence, this inquiry has to do nothing with the military activities. I understand there was an intelligence failure. I understand that. I know what happened there. This is not something I need this national inquiry to happen. The national inquiry needs to go to those questions. I'm talking about those heavy questions. How much should we invest? What is it that we should develop? How we can create regional cooperation? This is the serious stuff that the national committee needs to take care of. Not to figure out how a battalion leader did well or not well in this point or another.
So regarding the national inquiry, the state commission that many are demanding, including yourself, one element could be to bring to light information that's not currently known or that's not currently public. Another element of the activities could be to assign blame to people. This person failed in his duty, this person is responsible. Do you think that there's important information regarding October 7th or the decades-long lead-up to October 7th that's not known? Or is the main goal to assign responsibility? Or is there some other goal of the Commission of Inquiry?
Look, it's very easy to define responsibilities. It's definitely Prime Minister, was the Prime Minister for the entire 17 years, that need to be responsible. I'm not saying he's blamed for anything. I'm just saying he's responsible no matter what happened. You know, whether it's good, whether it's bad, everything is his, right? And I'm responsible for what happened on my side with the right relation with the governments. Different governments, by the way. One operation was under Netanyahu, the other one was under Lapid. So it's not, you know, it's not sidelines. It's a national issue. So yes, there must be some kind of fact-fighting to set the right reference in terms of facts. But the more important issue is to have the big discussion, because for a government to decide to initiate a war, this is not something easy to do. It's easier said than done. You know, we do military operations when we can. But you go to war when you have no other alternative. Now, the question is, what is, I have no other alternative? What is the right definition of it's too severe and I have no alternative, so I have to initiate a war? And this is a very deep and serious discussion that should be done by experts, with experts, in closed rooms, and to come to a serious decision. It's way above and much more important than pure politics. I'm sure that the prime minister will try to drop the charge on someone else will try to drop it on someone else. Okay, that's a side issue. I think whoever had responsibility on October 7th should go home. I'm not saying there are criminals. I'm not saying that they are necessarily blamed, but they are responsible. And if there is any value for the word of responsibility, do what Herzi HaLevi did. Do what Ronen Bar did. Do what Aaron Chaliva did. Go home. Now, I think all those people as I mentioned are national assets because they made the biggest mistake in our security history. And why can't we learn with them and from them from that experience? It is too bloody expensive to let this experience walk away and just do money somewhere.
I absolutely agree. I mean, as somebody who's I've served in the reserves in Lebanon, in Gaza as a simple soldier. But the weight of the decision to wage war is certainly one that needs to be considered critically.
Yeah. And if
I was to ask you,
you know what, when I entered the cabinet, the war cabinet, I saw those people carrying their biggest fail on their shoulders, but I have to win with them.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot just blame them. I have to win with them. And we actually did. Everything that you see around us, it's the same people who did it. So let them free from responsibility. I cannot let them free maybe from guilt, even in a few cases. But I definitely don't want to lose their experience.
So now, looking ahead, one of the elements in your Vision 2040, you write that Israel should look to expand military aid from the United States. I think you wrote to $5 billion a year. On the other hand, we've been hearing, certainly over the last couple of years, more and more voices from the left, but more and more from the American right, the MAGA, the America First, whatever you might want to call it, calling for an end to foreign military financing, to military aid to Israel. Given that we don't know who's going to be in the White House in 2028, do you think that Israel's goal over the next, let's say, 5 years should be to increase military aid from the United States or decrease military aid from the United States? And there are those in Israel also who argue that this military aid actually ends up tying Israel's hands or, you know, causing us to restrain ourselves or giving the United States too much influence in Israel's military discussion. So what do you think should be Israel's strategic goal in terms of the future of military aid from the United States?
Yeah, first, I think we have to expand our investment, Israel investment within defense industry. In certain element, definitely we need to do much more than we did before maybe, but that stands for us. Let me try to rephrase what you called American aid, and try to suggest to look at it as an American investment. Let's go back to the operation in Iran. 4 or 6 B-1s or B-2s or whatever it is flying over. Who prepared the area for that? Who enabled that operation to happen? Who set so much for this region more than the state of Israel? And definitely, since the United States and Israel share both the same values, but nevertheless the same interest, by and large, I mean, we see Abraham Accord, it's an American interest because it supports a region that supports the global economy and everything you can think of. Iran is a global challenge, it's a regional challenge, not just a threat for the state of Israel. And the United States is indeed the world leader. So the world leading element decide to invest in Israel. And by the way, as you know, most of our budget that comes from the States goes back to the American industry to purchase stuff like F-35 or any other thing you can think of. Many of the projects like Arrow 3 have been done together, and et cetera, et cetera. So I don't look at it as an aid. I look at it as an American investment in the forward democratic base in the Middle East. That's what Israel is for the United States. And we are a democratic outpost. We are a Western outpost in the region. I think we are the only country who don't ask United States to bleed for us, which is something we want to preserve. So I look at it as an investment, and I hope that Americans will decide to increase their investment in Israel over the next few years, because with the challenges are still around us, and it's challenging us. Look, the Houthis in Yemen. I don't know what the percentage of world commerce go through this place.
Mm-hmm.
Huge. Are we going to cooperate on this or not? Et cetera, et cetera. So I hope that people understand that. And as I said at the beginning, you know, I think we have to increase our own investment in that area of science and technology and force builder, et cetera. But the more we do together with the United States actually serves both sides, not just us.
To push it a little bit further, let's say that the United States did decide, President Trump has shown very clearly his support for Israel's security, his willingness to provide Israel with the military systems that he needs. He joked about that in his speech to the Knesset, that Prime Minister Netanyahu would ask for systems that he didn't even know existed. But in a scenario where 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the road, because even after the MOU, right, has to be reauthorized by Congress every year, there's a decision not to renew that aid or decrease the aid, would then Israel have to, what would Israel do? I guess we'd have to probably cut budgets from other places in order to purchase, to have the funds available to purchase the systems that were required. To my understanding, some of that aid has already been spent in a sense, or been committed in purchases that are already taking place. What would Israel do, in your view, in such a scenario where the president decided to reduce or to cut off aid, with the American president?
Yeah, let's hope it doesn't happen. But if that happens, I think we will have to divert national resources and finance it in another way. We need to have three pillars in our life here in Israel. We need to have strength. We need to have moral standards. And we need to have unity. We cannot give up on any of those. And in terms of security, that's to secure life. I mean, if we won't put whatever we have to put, whether it's American investment, whether it is pure our diversion of resources, then we won't be around. This is something we cannot afford. So, and you know, we have our capacity, and I think we'll figure out how to compensate for such an event if it happens, which I hope it won't.
Certainly. So let's look at what's happening right now on the ground. You have Hamas, as you mentioned, in control of Western Gaza, between the yellow line and the sea. You have in Americans, Trump's 20-point plan, which envisions an international stabilization force. You have statements by Arab leaders like King Abdullah of Jordan that they may play a role in training Palestinian police, but they're not going to sort of play an active role in confronting Hamas and forcefully taking the weapons away. Hamas put out an official statement a few days ago. I think they repeated it again after the vote, saying that Gaza won't be demilitarized, and that's an internal, and there won't be any international force. Assuming that Hamas has no intention of disarming voluntarily, do you think, A, that Israel would want to have an international stabilization force, an international force, either on the Western Gaza, the Hamas side, or on Eastern Gaza, right? Because there is point 17 in the 20-point plan, which says that if Hamas rejects the plan, then in areas under IDF control, the ISF, the International Stabilization Force, will take control. Is that a good thing from Israel's perspective? And let's say that Hamas won't disarm and the International Stabilization Force isn't deployed, but is not able to effectively take Hamas's weapons from it. And that may happen. We may reach that point in 2 months from now, or 3 months from now, or 6 months from now, or a year from now. But in that case, what should Israel do?
In my first cabinet meeting in the emergency government, I told my colleagues that soldiers that will have to fight in Gaza has not entered high school yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized it's a long process. Now, I can understand the decision made by the State of Israel to move forward with President Trump's 20 points plan, because, you know, it's unbelievable. There are only three hostages, Israeli hostages, inside Gaza, dead hostages. And I thought that that was number one priority for us, and we should have, we have arranged ourselves through this priority. It's not that we gave up all the other goals, but we just prioritized them differently, right? Now, I'm talking to you right now from Kibbutz Yad Mordechai. It's on the edge of Gaza. I still hear the explosions. It's a click away. But I think we did right for coming to that point. Now, Hamas will be disarmed and Gaza Strip should be demilitarized. If it can be done by others, great. If it cannot be done by others, we will have to do it. Now, it's very good that we are trying something else. Let's hope it works. But if it doesn't work, the kids I was talking about now going to their 11th grade, they are getting ready. And we will have to do it ourselves. Just as we will have to impose the agreement in Lebanon, just as we have to make sure that nothing threatens us from Syria, just like we have to increase cooperation with Jordan and Egypt to make sure that nothing happens from them, but over there it's with cooperation with those countries because we have peace accord with them, so that's very important, and I really appreciate their leaders, both President Assisi and His Majesty King Abdullah. I think they understand the importance of cooperation. But going back to Gaza, if someone else do it, great. If not, we'll have to do it.
So right now the IDF is, the yellow line is between 1 and 2 kilometers, maybe 1 and 3 kilometers from the border, depending exactly where. If there was an American proposal to say to the IDF, retreat 200 meters, 300 meters from the border, very, very thin perimeter, and let an international force control essentially the area between that very thin perimeter, right? So you have Israel, a thin perimeter, Hamas on the other side, and then let's let international troops take over security between Hamas-controlled Gaza and that very thin perimeter on Israel's border. Do you think that that would be the right move from Israel's perspective? Acceptable, unacceptable?
We'll have to take one decision at a time. We'll have to see how it works. I don't want to say it, but eventually, you know, international forces will come in, people will get killed, soldiers will go back home in coffins, and I don't know how the international forces will act to those kind of considerations. So we have no intention, I have no intention of staying inside Gaza in the end of the day. But currently we have the obstacle along the border. We have troops inside in different depth. Okay, it can be flexible, and they should be able to operate offensively if they see a threat on them or a threat from that area to our region. If something else can do what we are doing, fine with me. But I suggest to have another Zoom meeting in 6 months' time to see what actually happened. You know, if people are willing to kill and get killed in order to promote a mission.
I mean, if international troops are willing to kill and get killed.
Yeah, I looked at UNIFIL in Lebanon for several decades. Well, the results were not something, right? I mean, it didn't help. And we're in business now. We cannot afford to think after October 7 as we thought prior to October 7. It's the wrong moral strategic deed, if that's how we think of it. Now, once again, I'm not hysteric. I'll give chance to other activities. But once again, at the end of the day, if there is a security need, we will have to act.
Moving to the Judea and Samaria arena, as you pointed out, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, is 90 years old. We saw that the Palestinian Authority, in a sense, lost control of parts of the Palestinian Authority in the end of 2024 when terrorists took over the Jenin refugee camp and the PA failed to reassert its control, even though it tried, until Israel was forced to roll in. Whenever Abu Mazen leaves the world stage, a month from now, 6 months from now, a year, 2 years, whatever it might be.
Wish him health.
But at some point, it will happen. Should Israel's goal be to empower a Palestinian Authority that controls, let's say, all of the area that it currently controls? Is Israel's interest to promote the fragmentation, working with different families, different chamulot, like we saw an initiative in Hebron? Is Israel's interest to apply its sovereignty to, say, the Jordan Valley or to certain of the settlement blocks? What do you think is Israel's interest vis-a-vis the West Bank in the day after Abbas?
I think we need to make sure that, to try at least to support the Palestinian Authority in order to enable it to fulfill its responsibilities. Look, I would dare to say that most Israelis wouldn't like to control the Palestinians. All Israelis are not willing to take the risk of allowing the Palestinians to become something that might, at the end of the day, threaten us. And over there, we changed the reality in Defense Shield operation in 2002. That's from then on, we actually allowed ourselves to operate wherever we needed. And the more the Palestinian did, the less we had to do. The less the Palestinian did, the more we had to do. And that's the equation. Now, if the Palestinians want to govern their parts of Judea and Samaria, please respectfully do whatever you have to do. And if you won't do it, I'll do it, because I won't take the security risks. And I think we should strengthen them. It's not in terms of military capacities, but in security capacities, yes, to enable them to meet the demand of operating against terrorists. And I think they need to understand that those terrorists, though they are killing us, they are hurting the Palestinian interest by doing so. We are strong enough. October 7 showed everyone that even if you surprise Israel, which is hard, but let's say that you can do it, Israel is a strong country. It will never fail. So what will come out to it for the Palestinians? So we will take the more of what they have already in their hands, or gradually we can develop some kind of good relations with them. So I look at the Palestinians, and once again, the level of statehood is dependent, its future conditional performance-based concept. If they show they are capable to control their areas, they will control their areas. If they show they are not controlling their areas, or the incitement continues, or all those kind of things, so what is it that we have to talk about? I would dare to say that the near future in both areas, in Judea and Samaria, due to change of leadership, and in Gaza, due to this very complex situation that we are right now in, it's going to be some kind of chaotic decade ahead of us, at least 5 years that we'll have to figure out what's happening and how we can move forward. I think we can use, encourage, and utilize the regional forces to influence the Palestinians and the Lebanese and the Syrians to go in the right direction. Because if you want to be someone like the Emirates or the Saudis, please behave so. And make sure that that's what you do. You cannot be a radical, but try to live like the Emirates. It doesn't go together.
Let me ask you a last question about sort of about Israeli politics, but about politics in general. It seems like politics today tends to reward polarizing figures, certainly in the age of social media. And you, one thing that I think really makes you unique is that you have tried to build bridges. You twice joined a national unity government at times of crisis during the coronavirus crisis, and then part of the war cabinet during the war. And some could be argued that you paid a political price for that as well. Do you think that there is a political future from the point of view of politics for someone who tries to, you know, be a build bridger, or to, you know, put national interests perhaps ahead of their own personal political interests, or not? And that the only way to succeed in politics on a practical level is to be that kind of polarizing figure?
Yeah. Well, you know, in both cases that I entered the government, as you rightly said, there was some kind of emergency that made me do so, whether it was the COVID or whether it was the war itself. But what did it show me? Unity is a national necessity in Israel. It is something that the country needs. And since I'm in politics, not to serve my own personal agenda. You know, I was chief of defense forces. Nothing will ever come close to that. I'm not looking for power. I'm looking for a better future for the country. And a better future for the country has to come with this triangle. Strength, military, economy, scientifically. Moral standard of who we are. And unity as a society. Not uniformity, unity. I have no interest of serving any other polarizing concept from any direction. And if I can do that for my country and my people, my kids, my family, I'll be more than happy. And if you're looking for political radicals, go to the regional. If you're looking for someone who's a corrupt politician, go and vote for the regional one. You won't find it at me. You'll find honesty. You'll find me setting the country interest first. Being a centrist guy means that I do have agenda, as you probably noticed. In terms of security, I'm a bit lean to the right, but I'm very liberal and I defend the judicial system through the entire place. But even then, you know, when I was in the opposition, but the judicial overall started, I called for discussion and to come to an agreement, and I grew up in Mandate at the same time. So people understand.
Do you think changes are needed, that there are changes that are needed to the judicial system?
No, obviously. Obviously. There is a whole list. The issue is that this government has to go on, and we have to re-elect our government to reignite the confidence between the society and the government, and then we can come to an agreement on many, many issues, whether it's judicial aspects, whether it's religion and country, whether it's economical and infrastructure investments, security aspects, you name it. I mean, I can suggest the right priorities for the country, starting from education, going to international infrastructure, law and order, fair welfare system, because we cannot afford people to stay behind, and of course, defense and security. So, and we have plans for everything, but I want us to have a government of a Zionist, well and strong majority in the front that serve 100% of the society. It's not necessary going back to its own base, political base, and try to have some kind of sectorial perspective leading it all the time. We have paid too much for that, and we need to change it. And that's what I have to offer. If people believe in it, eventually they will support me. And if not, I'm in Yad Mordechai, and we'll see what happens.
Member of Knesset Gantz, Benny, thank you so much for joining us. And I think we'll take you up on your offer of reconvening in 6 months to see where we are.
Yeah, I think this is, look, you know, I told Netanyahu, when I talk, let's talk about it the day after. I said, I don't know what's going to happen there. Let's try, and it's a try and error. Let's see what happens in 6 months. I'm not sticking to my views. I'm sticking to the future of the country, not to my past view.
Great, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please make sure to like and subscribe to Mideast Horizons wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the Miskav Institute at www.miskavins.org and across all social media platforms. Send us your comments and suggestions at Mideast Horizons Podcast at gmail.com, and we'll see you next time.